This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jessica Yinka Thomas wants to see a world in which business is a force for good. And for her, good means more than just financial reward. She's the director of the Business Sustainability Collaborative at NC State and runs their B Corp clinic. And her work helps nudge corporations toward ethical, sustainable practices. She grew up in the U.S., Nigeria, and Senegal. And that perspective got her thinking early about inequalities in the world and the role businesses could play in making things better. And she joins us now to talk about her work at State and how she got there. Jessica, welcome. Good to have you here.
Absolutely. Delighted to be here, Frank. Thank you so much for having me.
I really want to talk all about the work you're doing now. But let's talk about how you got there and your parents, first of all, how they met.
Absolutely. So my origin story starts with a flying grape. And a lot of courage. My parents met at the University of Oregon when they were both students there. They come from very different backgrounds. My mother grew up in a small town in Northern California. Her parents came to the U.S. from Denmark and were entrepreneurs. My grandmother owned a clothing store, and my grandfather owned the jewelry store next door. And I think there were a few thousand people in her town, one stoplight. And so it was a big adventure for her to leave the state and go across the border to University of Oregon. A whole different adventure for my father. He grew up in Lagos, so in the capital, at least at the time, the capital of Nigeria, the most populous country in Africa. His parents, or my grandmother, also had a shop, so she sold housewares in the market, and my grandfather was an engineer. He built bridges in Nigeria, and so he worked for several years in a cannery in Nigeria, in Lagos, to save money to come to school in the U.S., and found himself one evening, I think through mutual friends, at the same dinner table as my mother. And they love to tell this story. Every time they tell this story, the table gets longer and longer. But apparently they didn't have a chance to meet during the dinner, but some glances were exchanges. I suspect some smiles. And my father says that towards the end of dinner, he picked up a grape from a bowl of fruit that was in front of him. I'm sure there was some silent communication happening there. He threw it across the table, and somehow my mother managed to catch that grape in her mouth.
Oh. There we go.
And that was that. And so, yes,
got
married after graduating, and yeah.
And in a lot of ways, that throwing the grape, because you talk about your father, and we'll hear more about that, his commitment to education, very structured, very rigid in a lot of his ideas mm-hmm. about how education should go and how people should behave themselves. So the grape story is kind of even better the more you knew him, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think he was taking a big chance there. He'd worked very hard to be there at the university. Yeah. He was studying economics. My mother was studying statistics, and so I think for him, well, I think for both of them, that was a big chance that they were taking for a number of reasons.
Now, you were born in Miami, right? But then the family moved to Nigeria not long after you were born?
Yes, that's right. So I was born in Miami, spent my first few years there, and then when I was getting ready to start first grade, we moved to Ile-Ife, Nigeria, and my father was an economics professor there at the university of Ife. My older brother, Justin, and my younger sister, Liz, we're all just a little over a year apart, each of us. And so pretty young kids, it was a pretty big change for us. I think for my mother as well, certainly. But
tough in school for you, right? A little bit? Socially?
Yes, yes. So, I mean, it's so interesting to think about how I was still the same person, moving from Miami to Ife, but how I was perceived was certainly very different. When we moved to Ife, I remember, the first summer we were there, we'd go to the market, the kids in the market would sing this song. It goes, Oyimbo pepe, chuku chuku pepe. And my father explained to us that that was a song essentially about white people and not being able to tolerate hot Nigerian peppers and how white people turn, you know, bright red when they eat hot Nigerian peppers. And I just assumed that they were singing that to my mother because we'd go together to the market. And then once we got to school, the kids would sing it to me. And so that was just a really just, you know, just an eye-opening experience to think that, OK, well, this is how they see me as, you know, as a white person. I have two Nigerian parents. I, you know, was new to Nigeria, you know, spent my first few years in Miami. But that's how I was perceived in in Nigeria. And then coming back to the States, you know, people look at me and look and think, here's a, you know, a young, you know, black woman, a young black girl at that time. So it's just interesting to see just how, you know, how differently I was perceived.
Yeah,
just
that
a
is
different
fascinating
parts of the world.
Think about that and how disorienting that might be. You did move back to Miami.
Yes, after a few years, we moved back to Miami for a few more years. And so I was still in an elementary school at that time. And we'd been going back and forth. So we'd come back to the States over the summer. So it was a bit of an adjustment again, coming back to Miami. But yeah.
But wonderful. And devoted to education and reading.
Yes, yes.
You participated in a readathon that pretty much broke your mother's wrist because she had to sign off on all of your books.
Yes, I was definitely one of those kids who just always carried a book around, right? And I loved reading. If I was standing in line at the grocery store with my mom, you know, I would be reading. And when I was in the third grade in Miami, actually, we all the kids, we competed in the readathon, which was a fundraiser for multiple sclerosis. And essentially, you know, we'd go around asking our neighbors for pledges. You know, they'd pledge a cent or 5 cents or 10 cents. I think some folks even pledged 50 cents a book. And then we had a month to read as many books as we could. And I loved reading, but this was a competition. And so I was a machine.
And your younger sister is competitive too, right?
Yes,
that
she
helped.
Is.
That
she
helped keep
is.
You on the beam.
Oh, absolutely. So she's 15 months younger than me. She was always a year behind me in school. So we definitely drove each other, very competitive. And so at the end of the month, I had read 364 books. I won the readathon for our school, for the whole county. But of course, my sister, who loved to read as well, she actually won the competition for raising the most money. Uh-huh. So she spent more time out there fundraising. I spent more time reading.
So. And therein lies a lesson, one of the many that Jessica Yinka Thomas has learned. She's director of the NC State Business Sustainability Collaborative, and we're talking about it today on The State of Things. So now you've established yourself as a pretty good student, a good reader, somebody who's competitive, spent some time in Nigeria, back in Miami. Now the family's back to Africa, this time Senegal,
right.
Francophone Africa.
Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. A whole nother change, a whole nother culture, a new language for us, and a whole new adventure. And I mean, that's how we really thought of it. We were, so my younger brother, who'd been born in Nigeria, so there are four of us at this point, and we were pretty tight because we had just been moving, you know, we'd moved around so much. We were this really tight crew. You know, now in a Francophone country, going to a Catholic school that had a very strict, very strict kind of old school French system, and just struggling every day just to learn the language, right, to learn the culture, to make friends.
But this is the kind of school system where you're actually having to memorize like whole textbooks.
Yes, right? I mean, so that was the model. I mean, so for our history class, for example, you know, we would, you know, the assignment would be, you know, memorize the chapter on World War II, right? And then the nun for the exam would call on different students and ask us to recite a specific paragraph in that chapter about a specific, right, word for word, verbatim. That was the test. And when you made a mistake, you got the ruler on your hand. And so I was very motivated, shall we say, to learn French really quickly, to learn this just new way of, you know, this new system of learning, these new expectations around just how we would learn these topics. And so I learned French pretty quickly.
Did you do well? Did you thrive into this?
Well, it's interesting. I did, and I think one of the things that happened when I was when we were living in Senegal is I became very strong in more of the math and sciences. I think more of the classes where they weren't so language dependent, and I just spent a lot more time. I was just much more. I became much more interested and much more engaged in those types of classes. And I think it was because I just got the ruler less.
Okay, in that one, huh? So there's the lesson.
There was a passion there.
If you want to improve in math and science, beat your students and ask them to memorize chapters and reduce World War II to a chapter.
Not at all. Not at all.
But it is fascinating how these things do have an effect. And of course, you do learn to incorporate them, internalize them, and then move on. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jessica Yinka-Thomas, Director of the Business Sustainability Collaborative at NC State. She runs the B Corp Clinic. It's work that pairs businesses and students to collaborate on developing ethical practices. We're going to talk more about how that works, but how you got there is fascinating. You're in Senegal now. You're in a fairly rigid structure, school system, where you're having to learn French just to get by. And then you move back to the United States.
Mm-hmm. We came back to the States. I was starting my junior year in high school, and my parents really wanted us to spend a year or more. So we were kind of all, you know, 1 year, 1 academic year apart, my older brother, my younger sister and I. They wanted us to spend some time in the U.S. before going off to college. And so I spent my junior year actually at a private French school in Bethesda, Maryland.
Couldn't get enough of the French education.
Well, I lobbied that entire year to go to a public high school and finally convinced my parents. I think they realized, okay, pretty much everything is done at this point besides the college applications. And I just really wanted to have a shared experience with my classmates. This is what I was hoping. I wanted to go to a regular American public high school. And so that was an amazing experience for me because I was coming from both in Senegal and at Rochambeau. We'd be in class from 8 in the morning till 6 p.m. I remember Rochambeau, my only activity was playing on the volleyball.
Was that the private school in Maryland?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I played on the volleyball team, and that meant basically lunchtime, devouring a sandwich as I changed my clothes, playing volleyball for 45 minutes, and then rushing back to class. And at the public school that I was able to go to for my senior year, I think we must have gotten out at 2:30 or so in the afternoon. And I took advantage of every single extracurricular opportunity that I could. I was on the math team and its academic team. I played tennis. I ran track. I was on the drill squad, the dance squad. I was in the school play. I started to learn the cello, and it was this whole new world that was outside of academics, all these incredible opportunities to meet other kids and participate in all these exciting extracurricular
activities. Well, it sounds like a great year, but had you been thinking about what you were going to do, you know, as a career, and did any of this influence your thinking now that you were back here with all these opportunities?
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, certainly for, you know, at that point, you know, my parents and counselors and everybody was thinking, oh, you should be an engineer, right? You love math and science. I think it was really you're good at math and science. I'm not sure. I mean, I really did enjoy it. But I was so curious about, you know, creative endeavors. And I really wanted to explore the more creative just side of myself. And so I think that was very formative. Because when I was deciding between, deciding which college to attend, I was fortunate enough to get accepted at Stanford and at MIT. And my father was adamant. He's like, must go to MIT. You're going to be an engineer. I think he was thinking, like my grandfather, that is, you know, the top school for engineering. And for me, I was realizing if I go to MIT, I probably, you know, that's the likely scenario, I'll be an engineer. And I really wanted to just explore other disciplines, just kind of discover who I was. I think I'd been on this track for so long, and I realized going off to college, this is an opportunity, right, to really explore. And so I had a day-long argument with my father, at the end of which we agreed that I would be going to Stanford.
Well, that's interesting, because he had seen some, like, U.S. News and World Report survey.
Yes,
or
yeah. So this was at the time that Stanford was actually embroiled in essentially an accounting scandal around how they were billing overhead around grants from the federal government. And so there were all these headlines. And you know, it was a period in time where they've got this incredible, right, longstanding reputation, right. But it was a blip. Of course, we discovered not long after that MIT was caught up in the same issue. But my father saw those headlines, read those stories, and I think he thought, coming from a global perspective, at the time MIT was probably, you know, at that time, more well recognized, more from outside the U.S. Than Stanford, and so I think that was part of his thinking. So it took me an entire day.
You did it,
but I knew I was making the right choice for me.
Well, talk about it then. What happened when you got there?
So I started out as a traditional mechanical engineering major. And I enjoyed the calculus and the math and the physics and science courses. And my first year, you know, that was my path. That's what I focused on. And I remember, you know, at this time, my parents were beginning to separate. So my father was actually living and working in Uganda at the time. My mom was still back home in Maryland, and so I'd call them over the weekend, separate calls, and I was doing really well in calculus, so I called my dad, and I'd say, you know, I got an A in calculus, and I remember that call where he said, and this is, he says, Inka, that's my middle name, and that's the, I don't know about disappointed, but I want you to listen to this. And he asked me, do they give A pluses at Stanford? And I said, yes, they do. And that was the end of that conversation. And I remember I called my mother and I said, Mom, I got an A in calculus. She's like, wow, that's amazing. You should be so proud of yourself. But don't forget, you know, go out, have fun, you know, make friends. You know, just this is your chance to really explore. I remember the next semester, you know, this is the balance, right? I call my dad. I'm like, Papa, I got an A plus in calculus, and they announced the midterm grades, and I got the highest grade in the class on one of my midterms. And he said, okay, that's what I want to hear. And then that was the end of that call. And of course I called my mom, and she said, told her the same thing. She said, Jessica, you're studying too much.
That's right.
You need to go out and just, like, she's like, stop. You need to go out and have fun. This is too much. And so with both of those voices in my ear, I actually changed my major from mechanical engineering to product design, which is in the mechanical engineering department, but an interdisciplinary major where I got to study psychology from, you know, Phil Zimbardo, who ran the Stanford Prison Experiment, and studied art and design. I did a semester exchange in Paris where I just got a chance to go to museums and study art. And so I think with both of those voices and both of those kind of motivations, was able to create a really rich experience for myself that was both very academically rigorous, but I think a really good fit for me personally, because I love that balance between the science and technology and the, you know, the creativity of right. designing products. I mean, that was the early days of design thinking. Many of my my instructors at Stanford were some of the early founders of IDEO. And so this is all of the, you know, the early days of human-centered design. And so that was, yeah, it was the perfect fit.
Well, it's when we became conscious of it. The fact is, you're not going to design anything that a human can't use. So if, unless you really understand how the human's going to use it, it kind of seems silly to pick up the old compass and slide rule, right?
Absolutely.
Which does lead me to the question, what were you planning to do before you made the switch as a mechanical engineer? Had you envisioned a career for yourself?
You know, I don't know if I thought that far down the road. I was really still immersed in this, like, you know, who am I? What do I want to do? I mean, this is kind of where I'm coming from, but I was open at that time. I hadn't really thought that far down the road.
So you're moving into product design. Talk about your senior project.
Yes, one of my senior projects was actually designing this set of gigantic building blocks. When my brothers and sister, when we were kids, we used to make forts out of sofa cushions. And so we'd build these enormous forts that we'd play in them. And then we just, when it was time to clean up, we'd just dive on the forts and destroy them and then put the cushions back where they belonged, like we were supposed to.
Nicely done.
And I, so based on that was kind of the inspiration for designing these, I mean, I almost think of them as kind of like life-size Legos. And so they interconnected and were designed for kids to, you know, think about structures and to build structures, but that were soft and that where they could just kind of jump on them and really, you know, physically interact with them in a real way. And so I think that really sparked my interest in toy design was that senior capstone.
And did you
project.
Try? Did you shop that one around?
Oh, to try to sell it?
Yeah,
No, that would have been a great idea.
Well, it's out there now. It sounds great because right now I would do those things and then I'd try to get a piece of rebar to hold it together. It's just like, it wasn't the rebar, it was the hole that you poked through every one of the cushions to get it to stay. That's where you get in trouble. So
yes.
I would have appreciated that. So now, when you do that, that's your senior project. You do have to get a job. So talk about your first job.
So my first job was actually a very traditional engineering job. I worked at a mobile satellite communications company for a year where I was designing these briefcase size satellite communications tools. And it was not a good fit for me.
Shall we say. Cool job, right?
It was cool. I mean, I was doing everything from designing interfaces to taking calls from people around the world who were having trouble with their communication systems. I remember I talked to a New York socialite who was climbing Mount Everest and tried to troubleshoot for her. And there were academics who were, you know, studying in the Serengeti who were having some trouble. So I talked to all these. Yeah, it was interesting. I learned a ton. The company was imploding. And so after a year, I was doing my boss's job because there had been so many rounds of layoffs and I was not qualified to do my boss's job. And so I left. So that was in Maryland. I left that company after a year and moved back out to the Bay Area. And I said, OK, I'm going to do what I love. And I remembered that, that senior project. And I said, I want to work at an educational toy company. And so my strategy, which I know if this would be the strategy I would recommend for my students, it worked for me, was I went to Toys R Us and I walked the aisles and I looked for toys that I thought were innovative and engaging and were really pushing the envelope when it came to educational toys. And so I had a short list of companies. I'd taken down their 1-800 numbers from the packaging. And I just started cold calling companies. I ended up being company one because the company at the top of my list was Leapfrog, which was a startup at the time. So my first call was to Leapfrog. They kind of passed me around before I ended up on the phone with the one product designer, the one engineer at LeapFrog at the time. I think there were 10 employees there.
Yeah, they were just starting up, right? They were essentially raising VC at the moment,
yes.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. This was early days. So they had two products at Toys R Us. Both were reading products based on phonics. So that was kind of the core products that they started out with as a company. And I got on the phone with Ransom, who was the designer there, and basically pitched myself to him. And he said, well, we don't have any job openings right now, but why don't you come in and meet the team? And I did. And they said, we're growing so fast. They didn't have time to post anything, but they said we could really use a second product designer. So they brought me on board as employee number 11.
Wow.
At LeapFrog. And I was there and was part of the team that helped grow the company to the third largest toy company in the country.
You developed
a pretty
cool product there that actually got recognized by Oprah, right?
Yes. So my area was I was brought in to really expand the math and science lines. And so one of the first toys that I designed when I was there, and actually have one
got
right
it here.
Here.
Yeah.
It's called the Twist and Shout Multiplication. And the idea was to completely transform how kids learn multiplication tables. I learned from flashcards, right? I think many of us did. But what we created is essentially this cylindrical toy with two dials on it where you can dial in equations and you can learn your multiplication tables. You can get quizzed on your multiplication tables. And the idea was to do it in a way that had a fun beat and that reinforced a love of learning math.
Can you demonstrate it for us?
I can. Let's see. All right. This is over 20 years old. All right. Let's see what we got.
6 × 8 = 40. 8. Sounds great.
So you're punching in answers, right?
Well,
you're
dialing in equations, and so it's giving you the answers. Yeah. And then there's a quiz mode, if you want to do the quiz mode.
Yeah, let's do a quiz.
Okay.
Learn it. Quiz time.
All right. Let's do it.
Hit it when you hear the right answer. 6 × 8 = 2. 48. Yeah.
Yeah, we did it. The two of us were looking at each other like 48. Yeah. Hit it. Okay, we said hit it. So that's a cool product, right? And it was very successful. As I said, was it 1999? I think
was 98. So this was an early version of it. So and there've been a number of different iterations. So there's still a Twist and Shout out there. That's just a new iteration of it. But this was a while ago.
That, I mean, it got it was you were on Oprah. It was featured on Oprah, right?
At that time she was doing kind of a holiday series. And she would bring toys that, you know, that she wanted to feature and to highlight. And so our marketing team managed to get the Twist and Shout on the show. And I remember we were all gathered around the TV watching the show when it aired. And she had kind of the kids toy segment. And I remember just kind of watching as there were all these kids kind of milling around, playing with the toys as they were kind of explaining each one. And there was a young black girl who walked up to the Twist and Shout, picked it up, and just intuitively started playing with it. And the camera zoomed in on her face. And I just remember her smiling and just, you know, singing her multiplication tables. And so that, for me, was the highlight of my experience at LeapFrog, was really seeing, something I designed in the hands of a young child, and just to inspire love, you know, a love of math, and create a toy that could really make that fun and engaging.
And even so, you're starting to have some other thoughts about, yeah, it's a great toy, it's doing good things. But your mind is beginning to wander again, wondering about corporate responsibility.
Right. So we'd get all these letters from parents and kids who would tell us, how the toys impacted, you know, their learning to read, learning math, learning science. But at the same time, I realized we were designing toys that, I mean, this one is, 20 plus years old, but most of the toys that we designed at some point were going to end up in landfills and in our oceans. And I think we were having, an incredible social impact, and we're really transforming the educational toy industry. But we at that time just didn't spend much time thinking about the environmental impact of the products that we were designing. And we weren't thinking about, you know, designing for disassembly and designing with materials that could be recycled. And that was something I just started to think about as I was leaving.
And the workforce, not to mention the workforce. Because again, as a small company starting up, you're going to have to promise investors something. Mm-hmm. And if they already know their math, those investors, then you got to promise them something else. That would be return on investment. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Jessica Yinka-Thomas, director of the Business Sustainability Collaborative at NC State, runs the B Corp Clinic. We'll be talking about that. It's something that pairs students with corporations trying to improve social and environmental impact. So you're starting to have these thoughts about, you know, how corporations can be more sustainable or more thoughtful about their impact. What do you do next?
Well, I head to business school in Durham, of course.
Gotta go to the Fuqua School or Keenan Flagler. You could go down the road.
Or both.
You pointed out quickly.
Or both.
Yeah.
So I decided, okay,
But you went to Fuqua.
I went to Fuqua. Yeah. I really need to learn more about how businesses operate, how we can build businesses that drive impact. The year I was exploring business schools, the late Greg Dees had just started the Center for the Advancement of Social Entrepreneurship at Fuqua, and I said, this is where I want to be. He's considered the father of social entrepreneurship, really, you know, one of the thought leaders in this, you know, this idea of how can business drive social and environmental impact. And so had a fantastic experience at Fuqua, had the chance to work with Greg Dees and some of the folks at Case, and that's what brought me out to the Triangle. I actually took quite a few classes at UNC Keenan Flagler. Mm-hmm. When I was a Fuqua student, my classmates used to joke and ask me where I went to school, whether I was a Fuqua student or a Keenan Flagler student, but there's some fantastic faculty there, and so I had an opportunity to learn from both academic institutions.
And now you're at NC State. So tell us what you're doing there.
Yes. So I have three roles at NC State. I like to stay busy. One is as teaching in our Management, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship department. I teach in our undergrad and our MBA program. Really, my goal is to prepare our students to use business as a force for good. Very much connected to that role, and actually the reason I was originally brought to NC State was to start and run our Business Sustainability Collaborative, and so that's an academic initiative within the Poole College of Management, where with that same vision that I have for teaching, and I have an opportunity there to work with our faculty to embed impact, purpose, sustainability across our undergrad and grad curriculum, work with colleagues on applied research, thinking about how can we take faculty research and translate in a way that informs industry. A third part of my work in the collaborative is building and running experiential learning programs. So how can we take students out of the classroom, give them an opportunity to practice what they're learning in the classroom in a real world context, and at the same time serve as a resource to the local businesses? So it's this, you know, it's our model of think and do at NC State, very much an applied, you know, how can we translate and connect to our local and global business community.
There are so many currents, though, that feed into this idea of sustainability or a positive social impact when you think about them all. I mean, on the one hand, there's the processes and products that we use. Are they toxic? Are they hurting mm-hmm. us? Are they helping us? Are they going to end up in landfill? So products and processes. Then there's the way we treat our employees, mm-hmm. right? And how, what ways in which we understand the people who make these products. And then obviously there's the products themselves and their impact, their use. How do we use them and what do they do for us? And unfortunately, there is some conflict there. We want products that are really cool and cheap. Well, that means somebody's going to have to get hurt, the environment or the employee. When you teach this, what's the balance in your curriculum in sort of instructing on all of these cylinders and a few that I just missed?
So Interesting. So that question connects to my third role at NC State, and really an area that I've been studying for 10 years, which is this idea of B corporations. And so the B in B Corp stands for benefit, but it's essentially a way of doing business. How can we build businesses that benefit employees, benefit the consumers, benefit the communities in which we operate, that, you know, manage our impact on the environment, and that do so in a way that's transparent and accountable. And so I've been studying B corporations for a while now. You can think of it essentially as an assessment that any company, or really any organization, can go through to measure their impact across their stakeholders. And companies that meet a certain threshold on that assessment can qualify to become certified B corporations. So companies like Patagonia and Ben & Jerry's and New Belgium are some of the more well-known certified B corporations. And a big part of that model is really thinking about how can you drive positive impact across those different levers, those different stakeholder groups. Do we have to, you know, do there have to be trade-offs? Are there ways that we can build innovative business models? The price point is still a challenge, to be sure, but can we build innovative business models where we're providing products and services that were made in a way that benefit people across the value chain, from, you know, the people who are working on the factory floor in that business model to the customer themselves, and how they use and maybe even dispose of, right, the whole value chain of a company. And so that's been a model that I've been really interested in for a while. It really forms for me the basis of how I teach, because we've got this incredible community of thought leaders and innovators in the sustainable business realm who are demonstrating every day their commitment to, you know, to equity and inclusion, their commitment to really, you know, having a positive impact on their community, their commitment to creating, you know, a constructive work environment.
And everybody wants to do that. Nobody would not want to do that. But the challenges are when the cross currents begin to flow into each other. If I want an everyday low price, how do I do that and not come at the expense of the environment or the workers who built it? Once the Walmart is there in that community, that Walmart has in a small community in a rural part of America that has annihilated the local businesses there, everybody loves the Walmart. Why? Everyday low prices. It's the only thing we can afford now that we've lost our jobs. And by the way, it gives us a place to shop now that we've lost our stores. So once you're the dynamic, it seems to me, is a pretty complicated and difficult thing to fight. How do you deal with those cross currents?
Well, I think even companies like Walmart are recognizing that they need to be able to provide those everyday low prices, but in a way that understands that I would argue that many of their stakeholders, their consumers, their employees care about local and social, local and global social and environmental issues. And so we're even seeing, you know, I think about 10 years ago, Walmart created an initiative called the Sustainability Consortium, where they are working with academic institutions, including NC State. They're working with Walmart suppliers to develop essentially metrics to measure the impact of their supply chain.
Walmart, the largest retailer of organic foods in America.
Yes.
There you go.
And the scale, like the power, you know, of the scale of a company like Walmart to be able to drive change across their 100+ suppliers. Now, you could argue, is it happening fast enough? You could have a discussion about to what degree are, you know, they actually using the data that they're gathering to make decisions about which suppliers they will use and how fast they are driving change within their supply chain. But I would argue that even companies like Walmart recognize that this is, you know, these are critical issues that they need to be addressing, because their consumers, right, are demanding. these products.
Right. And so there is some push in that direction, which leads to the whole question of education or the importance of it, letting people know, which is a little of what B Corp does. It alerts people to the fact that there is a certification, and if you know about it, you might look for it in the mm-hmm. places where you shop. So that leads to the question, who wants this? I mean, what are the companies that, and why? Why does a company want your certification or the B Corp certification?
Why would a company want to be B Corp certified? I think right now we see a lot of what we call greenwashing, right? So this idea, I think companies recognize that increasingly consumers care about these issues, use these issues as one of a number of different factors when they decide where to shop and what to buy. So increasingly we're seeing companies market themselves. We're green, we're sustainable, we are environmentally friendly, and it's hard for consumers to know which are the companies that are greenwashing, where they've invested a significant amount of dollars in marketing and a significantly, you know, fewer amount of dollars in actually embedding sustainability in their business model. You know, which are the companies where they're saying in their advertising, you know, we built an orphanage in Ghana and we're educating kids, but at the same time, they're using child labor, right, to farm their cocoa. How do you know which of the companies are doing that or which are actually, right, paying a fair wage for their cocoa, ensuring that there's no child labor, right, in that supply chain? And so I think B Corp see the opportunity to differentiate themselves in a way that is transparent. The certification actually there's a numeric score, right, overall score. There's a numeric score on how you're impacting your employees, your communities, right, stakeholders. And companies want to be able to demonstrate, clear the noise, right, and say, we have deeply committed to embedding these principles, these practices into our business to consumers, to prospective employees who increasingly my students, right, care about these issues. And they say, I want to take my talents to a company that's creating, you know, positive social impact.
And we have, by the way, the details of all of this, these standards at our website. So if you go to stateofthings.org, if not now, in a second or two, you'll be able to see precisely what these standards are. We're not going to tick them off right here. So that's one thing. And then I guess the other thing is the idea, and you said this earlier, it may not be a trade-off. Sustainable practices in many ways are actually smart business practices, wasting less, you know, creating less environmental damage, being less vulnerable to lawsuits mm-hmm. might not be a bad business model, right?
Absolutely. So increasingly, we're seeing that in the research, that these are strategies not just for risk mitigation, right, as you describe, but these are core fundamental business practices, whether it's being efficient with your resources, you know, attracting and retaining talent that has those shared values, whether it's driving you to create innovative products and services that recognize the resource limitations that we have or that are addressed issues around social inequity. I mean, these are the businesses that I think are really preparing for the future of business and not just saying, you know, how can we drive profitability today, but thinking about where is the future of business headed? What are the constraints? What are the opportunities? And how can we build just strong, basic, bottom line principles?
Do you think investors, because we're mostly talking now about consumers getting a little mm-hmm. wise to what it is they're buying and the impact of what this purchase, the broader impact. What about investors, though? I mean, at this moment, you know, the highest financial return on your investment is the top priority for most publicly traded corporations.
Well, I think investors are starting to realize that they need to do their due diligence, but there are opportunities to invest in companies where there's strong financial returns as well as, you know, strong social and environmental returns. So we're seeing people like Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock Group, $7 trillion that they manage, saying that we are going to use sustainability as a lens through which we are going to evaluate the businesses that we are going to invest those $7 trillion in. And if you look across the VC firms in Silicon Valley, every one of them, right, the major VC firms, has invested in one or more B corporations. So I think we're seeing really the, maybe not traditional investors, but increasingly I think we're seeing investors saying we recognize there's an opportunity for both financial impact as well as broader social and environmental impact.
I'm talking to Jessica Yinka Thomas today on The State of Things. She's the director of the NC State Business Sustainability Collaborative, runs the B Corp Clinic at NC State. What about the idea of, you know, you talked about this, the corporations now, investors are all seeing the wisdom in some of this. And I think about several decades ago, Dow Chemical Company spent millions of dollars fighting legislation that would have forced them to close their open-air toxic waste lagoons. And for years, they were successful in fighting it. Finally, they lost, and they had to clean up their open-air lagoons. And the first thing they did was eliminate waste or reduce the amount of waste, because that's what was in the lagoon. And so they ended up saving tens of millions of dollars by doing something that they could have done earlier had they not fought it. So there's a certain amount of, I mean, we think that business knows best and they're always efficient, but there's kind of corporate culture that can get in its own way at times, right?
Absolutely. And that's what we're trying to change in the Poole College of Management, right? As we're thinking about our role educating and preparing the next generation of business leaders, we want to make sure that they can act as change makers. You know, they're going off to start new ventures. They're going into very traditional businesses and everywhere kind of across that spectrum. And I think of my role as how do I prepare them and educate them so they understand, you know, that Dow example, you know, was there an opportunity for the company at their own pace, right, before legislation was put in place to regulate them to actually study the issue and think, you know, is there an opportunity for us to, you know, quote unquote, innovate in this space and do so in a way that costs less money because we're not reacting to legislation. This is a strategic opportunity for us. So how can we prepare the students who will ask those questions, right, and not necessarily be resisting, right, those changes, but thinking about how can we get ahead of legislation? Right. How can we actually use some of these challenges as drivers of innovation?
I mean, you save the lobbying money and then you save all the waste money. So I've left you a minute to talk about your career as a writer. You also have written two novels, right?
Yes, yes. So it's part of exploring that creative side again. And so I, you know, when I'm not doing any of those three jobs, I really enjoy the freedom of, you know, creating an environment where there are no constraints. I don't have to deal with the reality of laws, the reality of, you know, the physical world that we live in, and just kind of building these fantasy worlds where I hope to inspire each person who reads my books to think about how they can have a positive impact on the world.
We have links to those books as well. Jessica Yinka-Thomas, director of the Business Sustainability Collaborative at NC State, also heads the B Corp Clinic and the author of How Not to Save the World and How Not to Make Friends. Jessica, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was amazing.
It's all at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hullab-Mormon, Katie Barron, and Josie Taras. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.